The opposite of that's your circadian rhythm. And mm-hmm. the way to think about this is if you are awake for 24 hours, you might notice mid-morning the next day, all of a sudden you're either not so sleepy, or you might even get it like a slight burst of energy, which makes no sense logically, because you're like, I'm super sleep deprived. I should be even more sleepy right now. But that is that activating rhythm that your body is naturally on the upswing for your energy. If you don't fall asleep soon, you're going to plateau and then you're really will start to crash out. But understanding that can be really helpful for people of like, where is my circadian rhythm and when do I feel most alert or most sleepy during the day? Because that can impact the shifts that you're trying to work and how you're trying to get to sleep. If you're a delayed sleep-wake phase or night owl kind of person, most of those people, they can't fall asleep until close to 1 or 2 a.m. and then they want to sleep until closer to 11 a.m. the thing.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. And this week's episode, we're going to talk about sleep. Sleep affects nearly every aspect of our lives, from cognitive performance and emotional regulation to physical health and recovery. Yet many people still misunderstand what truly makes sleep restorative. So for this episode, I welcome Dr. Benjamin Long, who is a dual board certified sleep medicine physician and pediatrician. And we talk about the science of sleep and the habits that can dramatically improve sleep quality. Dr. Long shares insights from both his clinical work and personal experience, navigating sleep deprivation during medical training and parenthood. We explore the difference between sleep quantity and sleep quality, common sleep disorders, and the behavioral and environmental factors that influence our ability to sleep well. We also dive into a fascinating topic, which is rarely discussed in sleep science, the relationship among spirituality, religion, and sleep health. Dr. Long's passion for exploring the intersection of sleep and spirituality led him to write his debut book, Sleep Habits Journal, Practice Prayers and Devotions to Ease Your Sleepless Nights. Quick note before we begin, this podcast is for educational and reflective discussion only. It is not therapy or clinical advice, and listening does not create a therapeutic relationship. If you need support, please seek help from a qualified professional. Let's just jump right into the episode. Dr. Benjamin Long, welcome to the Easy Conversations podcast. Thank you for joining me. I'm looking forward to our conversation, especially around sleep. It's something I implemented a few years ago. I had mentioned to you, and I spoken to a sleep expert at the time and started to experiment with my own sleep and noticed a significant shift. And I think just even looking at it from a different perspective around the importance of sleep, and it's something I also discuss with a lot of my clients who are struggling in different ways. So we talk about the importance of sleep, and sometimes they wonder, why are we talking about sleep? I'm sure we'll get into that piece. But before we do, I want to give you an opportunity to share with the listeners a little bit about yourself, who you are, and what's brought you here today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. I've been looking forward to this conversation. And as you said, I'm a sleep medicine physician. I am trained in diagnosing and managing sleep disorders. Most prominently, we think about like insomnia, sleep apnea, narcolepsy. Those are the biggest ones that we're the experts at taking care of. And a lot of my own journey was coming through medical education, experiencing sleep deprivation, being a new parent, experiencing sleep deprivation with that. And so I think both my real life experience and then what I was learning in my education all came together and really ignited this passion in me.
Yeah, appreciate that. So help us understand what you were observing in your own sleep deprivation. And just for context, I think I've talked about this before too, but when I was doing my education, especially in engineering as my undergrad, there was a bit of like, at the time looking back, I think there was almost like some bragging rights around who could pull all-nighters and work on projects. But in hindsight, I don't think it was producing the best quality of work, I think there's a drop, significant drop off after a certain amount of time. So that's one thing I've been able to recognize, and often I'm focusing on too, is as much as you want to put in extra time in anything, it's what are the, focusing on what are the trade-offs when you're pushing yourself that far. So just want to get your thoughts on some of that and your own experience.
Yeah, no, I think my college undergrad experience resonates with yours, and that it's like, are you even doing college if you're not staying up all night the night before something is due and finishing it at the last minute? I'm a little bit type A, and so I was definitely, I tried to minimize those as much as possible. But certainly once I entered into medical school, for those who aren't familiar with it, you do 4 years of medical school and then anywhere from 3 to 6, 7 years after medical school for your postgraduate training. And medical school, it really is a like fire hose of information coming at you. Like I remember at one point we would have 1,000 pages per day that we would have to read. So there's like literally you could not like deeply engage into the material. It was really learning how do I find what's most important, find what's going to be testable, and get through what I need to for that. So that definitely was difficult because I was used to having a workload where I could actually get through it. This, I was like, it was practically impossible to get through all of it in the same way that I had studied in undergrad. And then also in my second year, I became a father. And so got very experienced with waking up to help my wife in the middle of the night, helping with my son. We were at this point in our schedules and work schedules that my wife worked nights and I was starting my clinical rotations. So literally it was like on our way to the hospital, there was like a McDonald's that was midway. So we would meet there. I'd take 2 bites of something, kiss my wife, and then trade child, and then we would go our separate ways. So definitely had a lot of experience with that. And even in my medical education, I would say the programs and environments that I was in, I was lucky that sleep deprivation was not necessarily ascribed that same badge of honor status. I certainly saw it in some of my rotations in medical school as I was going through surgery and some other different specialties. I definitely saw that it just is a normative kind of ideal of that if you're a if you're a good surgeon, then you are getting up, getting here at whatever early time and not really thinking of, like sleep was not part of the conversation at all.
Yeah, for sure. And do you feel from that time, like I feel that you and I are probably around the same age, but looking back now, do you think our understanding of sleep has improved? That's one thing I'm noticing. A lot of people are talking about it more and paying attention to it. And I think the misnomer, at least for a long period of time, was primarily focused just on quantity and not so much on quality, which is something you and I will talk about too. But yeah, I think there's definitely a lot more conversations around quality, and obviously it's easier to measure it too now with some of these devices, whether it's watches or the Oura rings. To me, it sounds like we're just understanding things better because not only are we understanding the science better, but then there are ways of measuring these aspects of the quality of our sleep.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the mid-20-teens, I would say, I think there was more of a mainstream effect on the conversation around sleep. A really big book, Matthew Walker's Why We Sleep, I think that came out somewhere in the mid-20-teens as well. And I think that was just hitting at a cultural moment where people were realizing how much sleep is important and exactly what you're saying. The wearables then just brought that to daily life for a lot of people. So whereas before that, I would just maybe intermittently think about my sleep. Now I have this technology that's giving me a report every day. And some of those instances you can find, you get immediate feedback. You're like, oh, wow, I had a little bit of extra alcohol and now my sleep score was terrible compared to the nights that I don't. So it's been really good in those kind of situations. But just with any kind of technology or changes or shift like that, then sometimes we can have a tendency to swing the opposite way. And what we found with some of those technology users is what's called orthosomnia, where people become so dependent upon their technology to tell them how good their sleep is, that actually becomes a barrier to good sleep, because then they start worrying about, oh man, my sleep score was this number and it's normally this. And they start focusing on that, and that makes it difficult for them to fall asleep. Yeah. Or instead of just waking up and intuitively, oh yeah, I feel well rested, like being able to make that reflective check yourself.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, let me look at my sleep score, because that's the thing that's going to tell me actually how well I slept.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important distinction that you have to trust yourself to. And that's something I've paid attention to. Like, sometimes the device or the wearable isn't as accurate. Like, I'll notice that it'll pick up times when I was up, but I was actually sleeping. So I've paid attention to that, but I appreciate you pointing that out. I often reflect on, how do I actually feel, and what's more important? And I think if I feel well rested and focused, then that's the most important thing. Now, another thing I've noticed, I think especially during the pandemic with our lifestyles being a bit restricted, I think that also helped from my perspective. And I've read some research studies recently where nightlife has dropped off. People aren't going to bars and pubs as much and staying up late. So I don't know if it's just healthier choices or just people's lifestyles have changed, but I am noticing a shift around that too, where people are perhaps not staying out late as much.
Yeah, I think my core training as a physician is in pediatrics. So my niche is pediatric sleep, but I'm certified and have experience and credentialed in all ages for sleep. But I think what you're saying is also reflecting what we're seeing in our adolescent population. This newest generation of teenagers have lower rates of like sexually transmitted diseases and alcohol consumption, smoking, and like all these other things. And I don't remember what podcast I was listening to, but someone was having a conversation and was listing all of these things of, look how great we're doing as a society. And the person who was interviewing was like, or maybe it's the fact that like teenagers aren't all of a sudden wise or anything like that. It's that we're really in this weird era of that like social connectedness through online presence. And that's leading to decreased connection in physical spaces. So I would wonder if maybe part of it is that after, certainly I think the pandemic had a big effect on it. I think there were changes that happened where then once we came back into society, I think there was a shift in the way that we engage one another. So I do definitely think that's part of it. But then because we necessarily had to have this increase in getting things delivered to our home or businesses making ways to make things more convenient for you online, that I think that has just then remained with us after the pandemic. And if I can live my whole life and get Uber Eats and my groceries delivered and I can connect with my friends online and all this other stuff, then we get this like feeling of connectedness. But I bring it back to, I'm a person of faith and I go to church, and I distinctly remember my first church service after the pandemic. And it was like a well of emotion just unleashed that you don't realize the importance of like physical embodied connection. And I think we all realize that in different ways as we were coming out of pandemic protocols. But in that situation, when I was in the first group of a large people in this setting, that's like really important to my meaning and purpose in my life, that I was like, oh wow, I didn't realize how important this kind of embodied connection was for me.
Yeah. Yeah. So in that, what I'm hearing is we just have to be a bit careful around, even though there might be benefits, it may be coming at the cost of the social connection, especially in the younger generation and population there. So yeah, I can definitely see that for sure. Now, coming back to the quality of sleep, from your perspective, what are some ways we can enhance that? I know you talked about alcohol, which can affect our rapid eye movement sleep specifically, and then marijuana has also shown similar effects, but that's just rapid eye movement sleep. But what about the other phases of sleep, and how do you enhance all of them? And I think also timing our sleep with our circadian clock. So some of those factors that can help people maximize all of those phases.
Absolutely. exactly what we were talking about earlier. So many times we know there's like a general number of hours we're supposed to sleep. And I think most people nowadays that I talk to, they're like, yeah, I'm supposed to get 8 hours. And it's in that 7 to 9 hour range.
Yeah.
But then what can happen is we can flatten sleep quality to just sleep duration, which as we've already alluded to, there's more to sleep quality and sleep health, if I would use that terminology, compared to just duration alone. And there's a pretty easy mnemonic that can help you, SATED, S-A-T-E-D. And so S is that satisfaction, what we've already just talked about, that initial a check when you wake up in the morning and you're like, how do I feel? And some things I like to pause for people here is, so depending upon the timing that you wake up and the stage of sleep that you're coming from, you might have what's called sleep inertia, where you have that initial kind of grogginess and you're like, ugh. But then if you actually get out of bed, start moving and start getting your day, then that pretty quickly within minutes should start to improve. So even though you want to check when you first wake up for the satisfaction, just make sure you're checking into that inertia and not mistaking that for inadequate sleep. And next one is alertness for the A. And so that is if just how your daytime functioning, if you are alert enough to be able to get through everything that you need to do that day, or if you're needing to take some kind of stimulants or medication or what have you to be able to maintain your wakefulness. And then again, another caveat here I talk to people about is that it's normal for people to have a mild dip in the middle of their day. So most people think of it as that post-lunch slump. And certainly, probably depending upon your diet, there might be some changes in your blood sugar levels and insulin and after a diet that could impact your wakefulness more so compared to other diets. But also, we know that your circadian rhythm is plateauing in that midday point too. So there's a part of it that is just normal due to the timing that you're waking up, that sleep pressure building, and then the timing of the day. And that really gets us back to the next one, T, timing, and what you just said as well, lining up my sleep to make sure that it is in alignment with what my body needs. Mm-hmm. We know that our circadian rhythms are genetically determined or have a strong genetic component to it. And so you'll hear people talk about being a night owl or being a morning lark. And that's truly something that is significant with the population. I like to bring it back to, if you think about when we were pre-industrial societies and hunter-gatherer settings, there really wasn't as distinct of a bedtime and wake time before the need of being in like a manufacturing job or 9-to-5 settings or things like that was determined in the Industrial Revolution, having to do shift work and things of that nature. But when you compare sociologically to pre-industrial societies, then you find that there is this like natural staging, that there's a certain portion of the population that would go to sleep earlier, some during the middle of the typical time and some later. As a species, if we just think about it in that perspective, it makes sense if our species doesn't all fall asleep and are vulnerable all at the same time, because then you could be eaten or something in the middle of the night. So we wanted to be in stages, so that way it makes us a little bit easier to watch out for anything that might harm us in the night. And so that reality is still present in our biology. And yet we don't always think about living into our circadian rhythms and what our body needs. So that T is, you can get the amount of sleep that you need. You might feel satisfied on certain days or things of that nature. But if you're a natural night owl, but you are putting yourself into an environment that requires you to get up earlier and fall asleep earlier, then that could impact your overall total sleep health. E is efficiency. And so that is the percentage of time that you're in bed that you're actually asleep. And this is one of the most common ways that we're talking about insomnia. So most people who, when we're talking about a clinical diagnosis of insomnia, that's difficulty falling asleep within 30 minutes. And if you're not maintaining your sleep, so if that total time to fall asleep or during nighttime awakenings is more than 30 minutes, then we would still classify you in that insomnia category. That's E. And then D is what we've already talked about, duration. So all of those things are different kind of pillars of sleep health. And so you can see real easily how if you just flatten it to duration, you're missing all of those other components.
Yeah. And then let's maybe talk about how we can help ourselves in order to improve the efficiency as well. So we've talked about alcohol. What about marijuana and then food consumption? And I think the other thing we don't necessarily fully appreciate is a cortisol release is typically highest in the morning when we wake up, and it tends to drop off. So you want to minimize any cortisol spiking activity or behaviors. And then I think the other thing I would probably want to touch on too is screen usage, especially leading up to bedtime. I think the blue lights from the devices can affect melatonin release and all of that, which is needed to fall asleep. So sometimes I think, and I do want to come back to some of the disorders, because I think people that experience insomnia, there are ways to navigate that too and set ourselves up for success. But yeah, I think just certain behaviors we should be mindful of as we're, I like to call it sleep hygiene, but just ensuring you're aware of certain things you're doing leading up to bedtime or even hours before our bedtime.
Absolutely. Yeah. And sleep hygiene is a good discussion for exactly what we're setting for the foundation to talk about, and just like making sure that you are optimizing sleep health. And yes, things like touch on alcohol, we know that helps you fall asleep. But in the second half of your sleep period, alcohol kind of flips and it actually starts to disrupt your sleep more. So some people notice it once you start pointing out that pattern, but you will have more nighttime awakenings in the second half of your night if we were looking at you in the sleep lab with alcohol. Marijuana, it is still variable. We have mixed results. It's been a minute since I've looked at the literature for that, but the last time there were some things that were looking at positives, especially for people who experience like chronic pain or things of that nature. But then also there were mixed results as far as showing that still not totally benign and could impact your overall quote sleep architecture. So when talking about sleep architecture, that's how sleep doctors talk about your different stages of sleep. So you have non-REM 1, 2, and 3, and then you have REM sleep. And so the difference is between those two, besides your brain waves, is whether or not your eyes are moving. And so stage one is really very brief. It's just transitioning from that wake to sleep. And you're usually in there for just a few minutes or so. Most of your night you spend in stage two, and then you will dip into stage three, and then you will come up to REM. And so the first half of your night typically is more deep sleep, or that stage three, or sometimes also called slow wave sleep. And then the second half of the night, you tend to have more REM. And I simplify it in my discussions and say that you can think of deep sleep as being really important for your body and REM sleep being important for your mind. Of course, all your sleep architecture, all of your stages and cycling through all those things are important for both your body and your mind. But what we do know is that as you're going into that deep sleep is predominantly more of a parasympathetic process. If you think about your nervous system with the parasympathetic, that's that rest and digest. And so everything is slowing down, your heart rate, your breathing, but then it's good for your metabolism, your immune system. You, pretty much you can name any organ system and that's going to be helpful to have that deep sleep to restore the stressors that your body is experiencing. And then REM sleep we think of as really good for your mind. We think of REM sleep as when you're dreaming and having that typical narrative, abstract, kind of conceptual dream. Technically, you have some kind of dream mentation throughout all stages of, but REM sleep is when we predominantly see that typical dreams when we discuss dreams. And so all that to say, any kind of substance there, so there's intermittent research that's showing that marijuana use is going to impact your sleep architecture. And then also there's an array too. You have your users who are just doing like a little bit, and then someone who is like a heavy user. And so that's going to be different as well. And so in general, I would say probably most sleep doctors are, if you are in the category of I'm an otherwise healthy person, I don't have a sleep disorder, I'm just trying to find things that are going to help support my sleep or support me to have good habits for my sleep, then usually most of us are going to say, don't add any supplement or any drug or anything like that. Like your body has what it needs to sleep. If anything, one of the biggest things, as you've already said, is light exposure and screens. we definitely, I think more and more people understand, yeah, I know screens are bad for me and the blue light and it's bad for my brain thinks that it's daytime. I actually hear that people just reporting that to me that they have read or line or online or seen or something like that. So I think that knowledge is out there in some ways, but what a lot of people don't think about is just any light at all. So just the light from your lights being on in your house, that is the strongest marker for your circadian rhythm that it's time to be awake. In sleep medicine, we call those Zeitgebers, which is German for time giver. And so the main ones for that is light, social interaction, meal consumption, and physical activity are the biggest ones. And that is a big one that I can will tell people to start with is actually just turn off all lights. If you have dimmable lights, fantastic. But if not, like you can buy for pretty cheap, like the little night lights that you can stick into a socket and that has a sensor on it. So it turns on when the lights are off. And so even that's dimmer would be better than just having all of your lights on. And so people, one of the common myths I see around sleep is that I can fill my life with whatever and do whatever activities, and I should expect it to be easy for me to just then switch to fall asleep. And it's, no, that's not how our bodies are created, and that you have to be enter into a time to transition to fall asleep. And certainly everybody is different. So there's some people that it almost feels like a light switch for some people I'll talk to. Inevitably, these two people marry. There's one who it's like, it's totally easy for me to fall asleep. I can do whatever. The minute I lay down, then I'm out. And then they're married to the person who it takes them 5 hours to fall asleep. And then they're mad because they're like, ugh, you're falling asleep. No problem. So everyone has their own barriers and things that they're trying to get over for sleep. But certainly light exposure and just trying to turn that off at a reasonable 30 minutes is great, but if you could do an hour before bedtime is definitely helpful, especially if you're taking a melatonin supplement or anything for your sleep, because melatonin, I like to tell people, it's just darkness in a pill. That is all that melatonin is doing, is just trying to say this is the conditions for you to fall asleep, but it's not going to make you fall asleep. Right. Especially if you take a melatonin, but then you're on your phone or your lights are on and stuff like that, you are severely diminishing the impact of that melatonin as well.
Yeah.
And then the last one you touched on too, the timing of your diet. It's funny, if you go back to Plato and Hippocrates and all that, there's some real interesting things in regards to sleep because they're so in tuned with what the body's doing. And obviously they're ancient science is not quite as accurate as our descriptions of things today. They, I think one theory of sleep back then was that you had the fire within your heart and then that started to cool and then the vapor started to rise and then condense in your head and then that's what makes you sleepy. And very unique imagery for around that. We know that's not the case now as far as accuracy, but there is definitely in ancient writings that you can look throughout both philosophical and religious traditions that link sleep to diet. And so that has been a link that we have known that if you eat close to bedtime, if you eat a really heavy meal, a greasy meal or things of that nature, that's going to impact your ability to fall asleep. And then also, especially if it's more of a fatty diet, then that's going to impact. You have two squeezers on your esophagus, your lower and your upper. That lower one is sensitive to those different fluctuations in your diet. So if there's more fat, it's often going to be less tight. And so you may have more reflux. And so even though you might be able to fall asleep, as you're going through your stages of sleep, that reflux actually might be impacting your ability to stay asleep too. So not eating too close to bedtime, having a good diet that has good fiber, you're not eating a really heavy, greasy meal right before heading off to bed.
And can you also touch on the cortisol piece as well, like ensuring we're aware of those things as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you have a lot of hormonal fluctuations that some of those things are going to be sleep dependent and some of them are tied to your circadian rhythm. So cortisol is one of those that we know has a circadian pattern to it versus, let's say, growth hormone. That's what I'm talking about a lot in pediatrics. We know that's actually sleep dependent and is dependent upon getting into good deep sleep as well. And so definitely making sure that you are aware of those hormonal shifts that are happening and for activities or diet or things of that nature that can impact those things. I don't tend to, just me as a sleep clinician, when I am talking to people, I don't really go into cortisol very much. I think it's helpful to know. If anything, my hormonal experience tends to be more around with women and especially perimenopausal, and talking about those fluctuations in the estrogen and how that's impacting sleep and causing sleep disturbances, and talking with women about the risks and benefits associated with hormone replacement therapy. So okay. I think that we have a lot of good research that shows like that part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Cortisol, there's definitely a lot of like interesting sleep science around it, but full transparency, I don't tend to think about that very often, but I'm happy to hear kind of like, what have you read or what are you seeing with cortisol and sleep?
Yeah, I think just generally, I think cortisol, from my understanding, is it helps with wakefulness and our ability to focus and do things. So if we are to do stressful things or increase cortisol release based on choices we're making later in the day, that can interfere with our ability to fall asleep. So so I think part of it is also based on when people are watching TV in the evening, being mindful of what you're watching as well. So if you're watching something like stressful or anxiety provoking or something like that, that can get some of that release, then it can also affect your ability to fall asleep. So just wanted to touch on that.
Absolutely. And I think my mental framework for that goes back to that parasympathetic and sympathetic. Mm-hmm. So definitely cortisol, adrenaline, that's going to be what's released in those kind of stressful situations. And so it is important to note, like you're saying, we enter into sleep as a parasympathetic predominant part. So if you are in that fight or flight response, then it's going to make it way more difficult for you to be able to fall asleep. So definitely agree with what you're saying there.
Yeah. And just to come back on the melatonin piece too, like a lot of people will supplement, but you said sometimes we can make choices where the use of melatonin is having no effect really, because especially if you're on a device or whatever. But in general, would you say that our body or brain is releasing enough melatonin for us to fall asleep? We don't necessarily need supplements. It's really our behavior choices that can affect it, the ability to fall asleep.
Absolutely. I'd say general population, a lot of times, I don't want to like rag on primary care doctors because I have fixed, and most of my career have been part-time working in primary care settings. Mm-hmm. So like you have maybe 10 minutes to figure something out, and then you've gone through three different things, and then someone's, oh, by the way, my sleep. And so I think very often physicians try to point people towards, well, try a melatonin supplement or things of that nature, and not really thinking about the mechanism behind that. Exactly what you're saying. Most people, your brain is producing melatonin that you need to be able to fall asleep. It's that we live in this electrified environment with screens and lights and all this stuff that we are taking us outside of what our biology is. That there's really beautiful thing in that, like most things that are alive on this planet have some kind of circadian rhythm, even at the cellular level. There can be differences of how active or quiet the activity is in DNA replication and transcription, translation, all that kind of process that waxes and wanes in the circadian rhythm, which makes sense. We have this rhythmic day and night that exists in creation that we have to train ourselves to stay within. The fun fact for sleep science for circadian rhythms, we found out that circadian rhythms are actually slightly longer than 24 hours, like 24.6 hours. Mm. And the people who found that out, essentially they like went spelunking and went to a cave and just stayed there for 30 days and recorded their sleep-wake cycles. And they found that it slowly slid forward. And I was like, thank God for you and your commitment to science. I would not do that.
Kind of a thing.
And the sleep, for the melatonin, I think the biggest things that I tell people for that too is just also like how you're doing it, not only for the light exposure, but also the timing of it as well. Mm-hmm. Most people, they take way too much melatonin for most of the supplements. And really there is evidence that melatonin at reasonable doses will help with being able to fall asleep in certain populations. But in general, most of the time what we're using melatonin is at very low doses, because it's essentially just like sending a quick signal to your brain to say the sun has set. is like the way that I think about it. So it's more for the case of helping your brain to, instead of being at that 24.6, trying to entrain it to stay in that period. So if you're using it to try and knock you out, that's not its use. The use of it as darkness in a pill is to show you where the boundaries of day and night are. Mm-hmm. And there are some populations that do need that. One of the most prominent we see is children with autism, but in other kind of neurodisability, there has been reports of altered melatonin secretion. And so there might be some connection that impacts your clock genes is what they're typically called, that are responsible for your circadian rhythm and the release of melatonin. There may be some alteration there where actually those children, their brain are not secreting melatonin either enough or at a period that it helps to keep them within the boundaries of day and night. So there are certain populations where it can be more helpful. But in this setting where we're talking about just things that I can do to make sure I'm supporting good sleep health, definitely is not one of the first things that I point people to.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're talking about the circadian rhythm. So for most people, it's easy to manage, but there are people who have shift work, right? Mm-hmm. As you can appreciate too, in your line of work. So how do you then maximize your sleep, and how do you enable it? How do you like try to line it up, especially if you're going to bed in the morning and you're waking up in the afternoon, depending on what your work hours are like, or if you're working a night shift? What happens in those cases in terms of not only focusing on the efficiency and feeling that satisfaction and alertness that you were talking about when it comes to sleep, but also for your actual brain health?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the consequences of that too?
Yeah, we are seeing more and more the connection with shift work disorder to a variety of different kind of negative health outcomes. Typically, the strongest of the research tends to be more in the kind of cardiovascular system. So when we're looking at things like blood pressure, coronary artery disease, that kind of thing, we're seeing increased rates of it and increased risk for it for people who are working in shift work disorder. That's the general knowledge off the top of my head. I would have to double check some of the literature to verify that, but definitely we know that it can impact your overall health. And so one of the things that we're talking about with shift work disorder is it is a misalignment between what your body's circadian rhythm is and what your working conditions are. And so a lot of times, naturally, people who are night owls are able to find environments where they work at night. And so I'm not aware of as much long-term research that has tried to look at that of, okay, are these people who it seems like they are genetically predisposed to be awake at night, do they have the same kind of health outcomes as people who are working shift work and is misaligned with their circadian rhythm? But in general, when we're talking about the shift work disorder diagnosis, it's a misalignment from what your body is wanting to sleep. So that would be one of the biggest things I would say to people first is, certainly we all go through seasons of life. Myself is talking about going through medical education and residency, and I had 3 years where I regularly had 90 plus hour work weeks and had a lot of sleep deprivation. And we could have a whole conversation on my thoughts on that and having to endure that. But the biggest thing I would say is not staying in that season and making that your whole entire life, trying to move to a place where you are able to get that sleep that you need. And so trying to find a career or find a job that does align with your body's circadian rhythm. I recognize that saying that, though, is an incredibly privileged thing to say. There are some people who it's just the jobs that they work, the environment that they find themselves in, they have no control over that as well. So I think some of that too speaks to my schedulers and my supervisors and the people who are creating those conditions of being mindful of how you shift people through their different shifts that they work. So one thing we say with the circadian rhythm being slightly longer than 24 hours, it's easier for us to shift forward than it is for us to go back. And so that's why a good rule of thumb for people who are schedulers is you want to shift people at a reasonable rate forward, because it's easier to do that instead of having people just flip-flop all around, just filling in gaps or things of that nature. A lot of my career was spent in the military up to this point. And so the Air Force Research Lab has this whole like fundamentals of shift work scheduling It's like a free PDF that you could literally just Google and find that has a lot of great research on this. So I'd highly encourage people, if you are experiencing that shift work and trying to advocate for yourself, and I'm just dying here, and you find yourself in a setting where you're having to flip flop and go all over the place, the thing that could be something to have a conversation with your supervisor with, of, hey, here's this like fundamentals of shift work scheduling. How can we find a place that is going to be beneficial for you and for me? Because what happens is when you're in these settings where you're just like trying to put out all the fires, people burn out. And so you actually, from the business perspective, they are going to lose more people, as far as have more people calling out, more people who are quitting or things of that nature, compared to if they put that investment in to create a better schedule. So that's more of a social, like systemic level of things. And oftentimes that is the best thing for shift work disorder. Certainly there are stimulants that people will prescribe. And then the biggest things I talk to people about are trying to mitigate that flip-flopping. But the best thing is really changing that environment to be able to sleep for what your body needs. But I'll add real quick that one of the biggest things I talk to people about is an idea called anchor sleep, which is where you anchor your sleep on your days off. So that way you don't totally try to flip back to days. It's very difficult and very common, especially for people who have other obligations like family or things on the weekend that they have to do. So they have to be awake during the day. But often what I'll tell people is, let's say if you get off at 6 a.m. and you try to go to sleep right away. And so then you're typically spending a little bit of sleep in the mid-morning. So one thing that you can do then is overnight, try to not sleep like an entire period. So just have a short, brief. Most people, they cycle through sleep cycles at about 90 minutes. So maybe do something that's close to 180 to 270 minutes, and then stay awake like you would for part of the night for your shift. And so then that's enough that you're sleeping sound, so you're able to be awake during the day, and maybe you might be able to take a nap. Is it optimal? Definitely no. Like, you definitely want to get a whole sleep period. But we know that for a lot of human history, that we also, before the Industrial Revolution and lights and things of that nature, actually even farther before industrial, even just like having candles and stuff like that existed, that those societies actually often had segmented sleep and would have a period where they fell asleep at night, were awake for anywhere from an hour or so, maybe even longer, and then fell back asleep. And so I think there is something within our biology that allows for that kind of segmented sleep, but there's mixed results and of what people say is healthy or is not healthy, of whether we should aim for segmented sleep versus more consolidated sleep or things of that nature. But if I'm talking to you and you're my patient in front of me and you're experiencing shift work disorder, then I'm going to try and reach for whatever I can to help you be able to accomplish what you need to while also mitigating any risks that I can possibly get at.
For sure. And with the segmenting sleep, it would be tough to get the full phases of the sleep, right? So that you're basically truncating them, unfortunately. Now, it may not always be possible, but would you say if someone's working night shift, it's probably best to stay on that schedule rather than flip-flopping? Because that does tend to happen a lot. So you're better off staying on one schedule.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Usually oftentimes I'm like talking to medical professionals and they take call every fourth day or something like that. So for those people, I'm like, try to do whatever you can before that sleep deprivation to help gear up for the anticipated sleep deprivation. Idea of sleep banking, where I'm going to slightly extend my time in bed in order to anticipate some sleep deprivation, it does help. Again, this is not a long-term solution. It's not a perfect solution, but we know that it is going to help with your kind of performance and wakefulness when the sleep deprivation occurs. But if you are on a long-term, where like I do a month of nights, or I'm on nights for my job in general, then yes, trying to just stay at that night is going to be the best thing. And then just understanding your body's regulation of sleep. So that circadian pattern, you can think of a slightly 24-hour waxing and waning pattern. And I tell people, think of it as an activating rhythm. So your sleep pressure is the opposite, where you wake up, That's building. This isn't exact, but roughly you can think of it as adenosine building up in your brain. If you go back to your biology class, you remember ATP, adenosine triphosphate is what you're using for energy. And so then the byproduct of that is then ADP and an adenosine. So you can roughly think about as the cells in your brain are using energy, you're getting more adenosine that's building up, and then that's going to start kind of processing and clearing as you're falling asleep. So the opposite of that's your circadian rhythm. And the way to think about this is if you are awake for 24 hours, you might notice mid-morning the next day, all of a sudden you're either not so sleepy, or you might even get like a slight burst of energy, which makes no sense logically, because you're like, I'm super sleep deprived. I should be even more sleepy right now. But that is that activating rhythm that your body is naturally on the upswing for your energy. If you don't fall asleep soon, you're going to plateau and then you really will start to crash out. But understanding that can be really helpful for people of like, where is my circadian rhythm and when do I feel most alert or most sleepy during the day? Because that can impact the shifts that you're trying to work and how you're trying to get to sleep. If you're a delayed sleep-wake phase or night owl kind of person, most of those people, they can't fall asleep until close to 1 or 2 a.m. And then they want to sleep until closer to 11 a.m. the thing. And so then they are most alert typically in the late afternoon as well. And so if that's you, then oftentimes you're okay with trying to stay up until a later shift and then get home in the early morning, and then you're able to fall asleep fine. If you have a typical circadian rhythm and your body wants to wake up in the mid-morning, then usually what I'm telling people is try as much as possible to schedule your shifts to where you are wearing blue light blocking glasses, or if you don't have that, just sunglasses, and really trying to minimize that light exposure. Don't eat anything, go home, go straight to bed, block out the light with the curtains and everything like that, and then just try to sleep as much as you possibly can. And understanding, if I get home at 7 a.m., but I know my circadian rhythm, I'm going to start wanting to be awake around 10 a.m., just get those 3 hours of sleep that you can get. And then instead of tossing and turning from 10 to noon, actually get up and start doing things in your day. And then utilize that post-lunch slump that your circadian rhythm tends to level off to take another nap before going into work. Again, that's going back to that segmented sleep where you're not necessarily going to be getting the consolidated sleep. But if I had to choose between segmented sleep but getting 7 hours versus all together but I only get 5 hours of sleep, I would much rather give you 7 hours.
Okay. Well, that's helpful for sure. So perhaps it's worth shifting into some of the sleep disorders that you touched on right at the beginning. You talked about insomnia, sleep apnea, and then narcolepsy, I think is the third one. So are you able to talk through each one, and perhaps what are some ways people can help improve their sleep? Now, there are certain things that you're just limited, right? Like with sleep apnea, it is a function of your breathing and all of that. And that can definitely affect your sleep in general, and maybe you're limited in terms of what you can do, but generally speaking, what are some things people can do to be aware of these disorders and help themselves as much as they can?
Absolutely. I'll start with narcolepsy because that tends to get the least recognition.
Right.
But it also, in my opinion, I would say is overdiagnosed. And this is the reason why, is because it's actually pretty difficult to get the testing for narcolepsy. The gold standard and labs I've worked at is called a Trident protocol. Not everybody calls it that. That's just what we do. And then it has three parts. You have some kind of discussion of or objective measurement of what your sleep is before you get a sleep study done. Most people might get like a sleep diary. Technically, that is a subjective experience. There's going to be some people who report their sleep really well and some people who don't. So some labs will do actigraphy, where you wear a watch that monitors your wake sleep cycles while you're filling out a sleep diary, and we compare those that both of that information in order to get the best information. And then after that, you do a sleep study and just typical sleep study overnight where you're hooked up to everything. And then you stay the next day and you'll do 5 naps. And then if you fall asleep quickly on average for over across all of those naps, as well as enter into that REM sleep really quickly, that's when we diagnose you with narcolepsy. And so the problem is if my sleep, if I have severe sleep apnea as well as insomnia or things of that nature, and it's fragmenting my sleep, in seasons of my life, it can seem like I have narcolepsy. Like I will have people who are referred to me, they're like, "Doc, I am like falling asleep in important board meetings and things of that nature. And I just can't help but be like, fall asleep. I just have these sleep attacks and it comes out of nowhere and I don't know what's going on." But then when you dig into the history, it's also with these points in time where I have terrible insomnia, where I'm not able to fall asleep. And truly from a diagnostic perspective, narcolepsy, when it is caused by changes you don't have, commonly we think of it as you don't have enough orexin in your brain, and that's a stabilizer of your weeks of your wake sleep states. And those people, you're not going to have periods of true insomnia where it takes me hours and hours to fall asleep. So that is a different story, a different narrative compared to people with narcolepsy. Most predominantly are going to have prolonged, persistent, consistent difficulty with just maintaining wakefulness all the time. And so not only insomnia, but severe sleep apnea. If I have pauses in breathing that are fragmenting my sleep because I literally pause every single minute or something like that, that can cause me to be really sleepy during the day too. And so technically why we have that huge workup is if I get that sleep diary and it shows that you're not even getting enough adequate sleep, you're only getting 5 hours of sleep, that's insufficient sleep. I can't go on to actually diagnose narcolepsy. The next part, if I do a sleep study and then I'm diagnosing you with severe sleep apnea, I should not go on to the next point and do the NAP test to try and diagnose you with narcolepsy. Unfortunately, what I see from some sleep labs is that they just continue the whole thing and then they say, "Oh, you've got severe sleep apnea and narcolepsy." The problem with that is the very last part of the diagnostic criteria for narcolepsy is it cannot be better explained by some other condition. And so if I have undiagnosed severe sleep apnea and that's not being treated, then that's the diagnosis I need to start with. And I don't always see that distinction. And so I say that because I see people online who are like talking about getting a narcolepsy diagnosis. And sometimes it makes me pause because I understand how easy it is to mimic those symptoms. Now, the flip side of that, narcolepsy is a debilitating disease and that it makes it really difficult for people to function because they cannot stay awake. And then we also have a separate hypersomnia category called idiopathic hypersomnia, where it's like, okay, on our objective testing, you don't have sleep apnea, you don't have insomnia, you're super sleepy, but you don't quite meet criteria for narcolepsy. Some of those people are just early narcolepsy that if we follow them for 10, 15, 20 years, they'll eventually develop into narcolepsy. And then like idiopathic says, we don't know exactly why. They're just some people who are super sleepy. And so what we know from the natural timeline to diagnosis in hypersomnia, whether it's idiopathic hypersomnia or narcolepsy, it can take a really long time to get a diagnosis. So that is really difficult for people who are experiencing narcolepsy because they get these fatigue workups. They get a referral to a sleep doctor, but just have a sleep study done and not the full workup for narcolepsy. They can have all of these hoops that they're going through. So it can be a 5-10 year process before they even get a diagnosis. I definitely would encourage listeners, if they are experiencing difficulty maintaining wakefulness, like, "I sleep 11 hours and I still like cannot, I don't snore, I don't do anything or anything like that," then I think it is reasonable to advocate for yourself to be able to get to a sleep lab that's going to do that narcolepsy testing. With the caveat of, if I have severe sleep apnea, if someone's trying to rush me to a narcolepsy diagnosis, in my opinion, I would say, no, we got to treat that sleep apnea first to see how much that is impacting. And then there are medications that previously, there was one that was approved for narcolepsy and wasn't approved for idiopathic hypersomnia. Now that it's been approved for idiopathic hypersomnia, it's less functionally important to make a differential between those two diagnoses because I can prescribe the same medication for both of them. The problem with the medication is I tell people it's like a cousin of the date rape drug because it's sodium oxybate. And so because of that, it like knocks you out, and it's good in that it gets you into deep sleep, but you are out during that period of time. So especially if you are a caretaker, then like that's something that you have to talk about if you're on that medication. And it's like there's one pharmacy in all of America has a very controlled substance and stuff of that nature. Not everyone's going to be able to prescribe that kind of a thing. So it's definitely needs to have a really big, serious conversation on talking about that compared to the other option would be like taking a stimulant to help you during the day. So that is a overarching for narcolepsy. For sleep apnea, like you said, just having pauses in breathing that can either come from some obstruction and from like my nose to my neck, or it could be pause in breathing where my brain is telling me not to breathe. Everybody is going to have an occasional pause in breathing as they're going through their different stages of sleep at some point on some nights of their sleep. So just because you witness that you have a pause in breathing occasionally or something like that isn't necessarily that you definitely have sleep apnea, which is why it's important to get testing for it. But if you are snoring super loud, and I tell people, like, I have moms who like show me a video of their like kids and the kids like kind of thing, then I'm like, yeah, you need a sleep study. And so the obstructive sleep apnea that's in children, oftentimes that's due to enlarged adenoids and tonsils. In adults, that can be a variety of things. The biggest difficulty with that tends to be around your BMI and adiposity. As you're adding more weight to your body, that can include your upper airways and like your tongue as well. And so we know that if you have like mild sleep apnea, but you're significantly overweight to obese, sometimes just losing that weight could actually reverse the diagnosis. So that is like a long-term thing that we are talking about. And then when we're talking about medication options, now there was a trial for like tirzepatide to look at those weight loss drugs to help with sleep apnea. And they found a significant improvement in people's sleep apnea with these weight loss drugs. So I really think in the next 5 years, that's going to be a major shift in how we are talking about sleep apnea instead of just jumping to the CPAP, how a lot of sleep doctors have been trained to. Really what we should have been, and I've tried to advocate for a long time, is also looking at the big picture and saying, no, if we're overweight, obese, we got to talk about losing that weight and seeing how that impacts the sleep as well.
Yeah. And is there age-related factor too with sleep apnea?
Yes.
As
you age, so all your structures, you have your muscles in your neck, your tongue, all of that is naturally going to relax as you fall asleep. And so you can think about it as you get older, in general, things get more loose and floppy and things of that nature. So that increases your risk for sleep apnea as you get older. And actually for women, we think there's also some hormonal component too, because women tend to be at a lower risk compared to men, although there is more research that's coming out to show that sleep apnea may be underdiagnosed in women because they don't always present the way we think about with a super loud snorer with obvious pauses in breathing. And I think that's a part of the conversation. But after menopause, we find that many women, there's a kind of a jump in the diagnosis of sleep apnea as well. And so we think there might be some hormonal component that estrogen is actually protective of sleep apnea as well. And so definitely those can be a risk factor. Family history can be a risk factor as well. So if the more eggs you put in the basket, if I'm snoring, if I'm having pauses in breathing, if I'm having a jump in how much I have to get up and pee overnight, if I'm having headaches in the morning, we can, all of those things you can jump. Or, but like we said, for women, sometimes it's just, I have difficulty maintaining the sleep. They say I can fall asleep, no problem. But then as I wake up and I just can't fall back asleep. And then sometimes they'll even say, yeah, maybe I slightly feel like I'm choking or I'm dreaming like I'm choking before I wake up. And it can be these like subtle stories that once you put them in the sleep lab, you find out, oh no, you have sleep apnea. We need to do something about that.
Yeah. And then with insomnia, do you feel that it's often misdiagnosed too? Because as we've talked about so many things around just sleep hygiene, if that's not in place, it may seem like you have insomnia, but maybe you just need to make some lifestyle adjustments.
Yeah. I would say people are often surprised in finding out when I talk to people about insomnia. I actually don't even talk about sleep hygiene until maybe my third, fourth, or even fifth visit. Because the reason is sleep hygiene is really good at fixing sleep hygiene. If I'm doing any of those things and those things are barriers to good sleep, then yes, definitely need to do that. But insomnia as like a separate entity, it doesn't get at the root problem for insomnia. We used to, in the past, say like primary versus secondary insomnia, but that was really hard to differentiate because as we've talked about too, there can be other things or disorders or stuff like that become barriers to good sleep. So it was really hard to differentiate. Is primary insomnia a thing? Are there times when people are just not able to sleep and it's not secondary to some kind of cause? And so now we just lump everything to a timeline of chronic insomnia. But that can be very different for a child who doesn't have the skill of being able to fall asleep by themselves in a certain kind of environment, or the adult who has a super stressful job and they're worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow and thinking about everything on their to-do list and all that stuff. So it's like both of those are chronic insomnia, but then the root of that is very different. And so right now we think about insomnia in the three P's, that you have some kind of predisposing factor that makes it closer for you to get to some kind of insomnia threshold. And then stacked on that is some precipitating factor. Those are all of the life stressors that I tell my patients to live is to experience precipitating factors. Like you're going to be stressed. And oftentimes that puts you above the insomnia threshold. And so the key for insomnia treatment then comes to that last P, which are perpetuating factors. These are maladaptive behaviors that help you in the short run, but then in the long run are actually perpetuating your insomnia. And so this is what we are trying to address in cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And the reason why we don't jump to sleep hygiene is because what it does is often people will, the most prominent ones are sleep in and take a long nap. And that's good in that you get more sleep and so you're able to feel well rested. But if we go back to that two process regulation of sleep, that sleep pressure, if you sleep too much or too close to your bedtime, then that is going to steal your sleep pressure from being able to fall asleep tonight or even the next night. And so CBTI is geared at trying to not only help create some guardrails for that to limit those maladaptive behaviors, but then also gets back to those thoughts that could be impacting your sleep. The most common thing are my clock watchers and my overthinkers is what I call them.
Yeah.
Thinking about all the stuff of the stress of today, or, oh my gosh, I said this to this person and what do they think of me and how this or whatever. Or the person who's thinking about tomorrow, or they're looking at their clock and they're like, if I fall asleep now, then I'll have 3 hours and 47 minutes of sleep. If I fall asleep now, I'll have 2 hours sleep thing. And so those are specific behaviors that fall outside of that sleep hygiene recommendations that we know are closer to the root of perpetuating people's insomnia. So we want to address those things first. And then the last thing that we think about with insomnia too is this concept of what's called a conditioned arousal. And that is where if you have suffered with insomnia and tossing and turning in your bed for months and years and decades, then what's happened is you've conditioned your brain to not only think of the bed is a place to sleep, but it's also a place to worry. It's a place to be awake. It's a place to be frustrated. And so that conditioned response becomes a barrier to your sleep. And often I will hear it in my patients when they say, I will be falling asleep on the couch, but the minute I try to sometimes even think about going to bed, or I start going to bed, or I start to lay down, all of a sudden I'm wide awake. And we think part of that psychologically is that conditioned response.
Yes.
And so some of the therapy then for insomnia is trying to break that. So that's going back to that E and sated, the efficiency. We're trying to maximize your efficiency that you're using the bed for just sleep. Oftentimes in CBTI, depending upon people's lifestyle, we will say sleep and sex. But in general, we are trying to make the place of sleep not something where it's worry or frustrated or a high stressor, thing of that nature.
Yeah. And you'd referenced Matt Walker earlier. I heard him on a podcast once talk about if you're having trouble falling asleep, try to change, go to another room. So to your point, you're not conditioning your bed with a place of not being able to fall asleep. So I think there are certain things you can do. If you go to another room until you're falling asleep, then come back. Sometimes those are ways of mitigating that conditioned response as well.
Yep, absolutely.
The other thing you talked about, and I want to test this with you. So when I have clients who say they're having problems falling asleep because they're ruminating about their day, maybe they have work stress and they're thinking about all the things they need to do or some interaction that they're thinking about over and over. One of the things I often suggest to them is journal before you go to bed. So try to get everything out of your head onto paper. whether it's your to-do list or things that happen during the day that are bothering you, at least you've gotten out of your head and it's no longer in there. I don't know if that's good practice. It seems to work for a lot of clients, but I mean, there's no, at least I haven't done significant research to say that there maybe there is something there, but it, yeah, like I said, it seems to work for most people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is a perfect first line intervention if someone just has recognized that's something that I do, that I have a lot on my brain that I can't get off, that our brain makes it really easy to hold on to things because we don't want to forget them. So then just offloading that is going to be able to help relieve that load on your mind. The slight tweak that I would make to that recommendation would just be making sure you're doing it before bedtime and out of the bedroom for that same reason, for the conditioned response. So I'm like, don't journal all your worries in bed, because then you're doing the exact thing that you don't want to do if that conditioned arousal is present. That's not necessarily going to be present in all people who experience insomnia, but we know if that is a piece of the puzzle, there's no medication or no other kind of intervention that's going to break that conditioned response. So I am always trying to tell people, yeah, if you do that, just do it outside of the bedroom. Some people, they have a big enough bedroom where they just have a desk or a chair or something on the other side of the room. So sometimes it can just be helpful just to be out of your bed, but not in your typical sleeping environment. The safest thing would, or not safest, but the least likely to create a conditioned response would be outside of your bedroom.
Okay. No, that's helpful. All right. So let's maybe shift gears a little bit here, because one of them, I think, main things we also wanted to touch on, and I was really excited to explore some of the research you've come across, but the role of spirituality and really religiosity to sleep quality. What are some things you've come across and what's going on there?
Yeah, that was one of my first ventures into looking at like the social determinants of sleep health. If we think about social determinants, that is like, how does our environment, the people that are around us, impact certain parts of my health? So you'll also hear just social determinants of health. But for sleep health, we very commonly talk about neighborhood violence and just the socioeconomic status of the neighborhood that I am living in. We know that there, if there's increased violence, that same thing we were talking about, increased sympathetic, because I'm frightened for my life frequently, that's going to become its own barrier to sleep, that I could be the best sleep doctor and address all of the things, but if I'm not thinking about, that's also going to be a piece of the puzzle for a barrier to your sleep. So what I found, though, that was interesting is we talk about that, but then there are other social determinants of sleep health. So the most prominent one we were just talking about is religion or spirituality, that in a way seems to be a direct buffer, but also just seems to mitigate some of the barriers to good sleep. And yet it's not often talked about in the conversations around social determinants of sleep health. And so I initially was like, there's just probably not a lot of research in this area. And it's true that there's bigger research in other areas, but we do actually have a growing body of research to show there does seem to be something here. That people specific, if we go back to insomnia, talking about my thoughts and my behaviors can impact my ability to fall asleep, then maybe there's something that works in the opposite direction, where maybe are there certain thoughts or behaviors that do tend to promote better sleep? And so one of those things within religiosity goes back to our beliefs of the divine. And so I come from a Christian faith tradition, and in America, that tends to be a larger population. So that's where most of the research in religiosity is found. Mm-hmm. There are significant research from other places around the world, from Muslim backgrounds and Jewish backgrounds, and the Abrahamic faiths tend to be the most predominant that I have seen. And so if we're thinking in a broad perspective, if I believe that there is a divine that is sustaining and creating the world and this kind of over things that I trust daily, that is a very different belief and narrative compared to if I look out into the world and all I see is chaos and a lot of stuff that I have absolutely no control over. And so one of the frameworks for how religion impacts your sleep is that, as far as just literally being able to change our beliefs and make it easier for us to be in that parasympathetic response. Some of that is actually embodied practices as well. So things of like prayer, fixed yes. times of prayer and things of that nature, being able to be input into our circadian rhythm to mark when we're supposed to be awake, when we're supposed to cease from our day and things of that nature, that creates mm-hmm. these boundaries that we, in our current culture, we don't have that. There's not anything in just mainstream culture that's stop, pause, take a moment. We're getting more of that in wellness culture, and I think that's really good. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing with religion is that there also seems to be some component to religious service attendance. But then at the same time, I don't want to necessarily highlight all of the positive things and not the negative. So there does seem right. to be a flip side and a dark side to some of this too. If I have like a certain amount of, whether it's classified as religious OCD or just more of a level of, if I don't say my prayers, then I feel guilty because I'm not adhering to my faith tradition. And so then that becomes like a barrier to my sleep. Yes. That can be a side of things too. Or if I am experiencing doubts about my faith, I'm going through this season where I am, is this really what I believe? Or am I believing something else and having those kind of crises? Then that can become a barrier to your sleep as well. So it just became obvious to me that it seemed like this is a significant part of people's lives. And yet I was not trained to really talk about it. Mm. And so then one thing I started doing was just asking all of my patients, is religion or spirituality an important part of your daily life? And then I was surprised by the number of people who said, yes, they come from some faith tradition. And then would say, I read the Bible, I pray, or things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And yet when it came to responding to their insomnia, very often they would not rely on any of their religious kind of resources to be able to respond to their insomnia.
Yeah.
And so for me, since I'm Christian from the Christian faith tradition, that led me to, okay, maybe there is some way that I can bring theology and bring medicine together to help a resource for this kind of specific population. And so that's what I did with my book, Sleep Habits Journal, was to take the evidence-based medicine, the things that are helpful for insomnia, that we have good science to back it up. But the thing that we don't realize today is that all science has some kind of philosophical foundation, some kind of worldview that we're coming from too. Mm-hmm, and so even if I'm talking to someone who has no belief in a God, an atheist, I say you are technically operating from a theology because you're operating from a belief that there is no God. And so that's right. going to lead you to certain purposes, certain assumptions, certain worldviews compared to someone who is operating out of a view that there is a God. Mm-hmm. And so it was trying to create a resource that not only bridges that gap, but helps us to think about the narratives that we assume in modern day culture of sleep. And maybe how is that different from what we receive, at least for Christians, from the Bible?
Yeah. And I would assume, because we've talked about some of the issues that can prevent sleep. So if someone's ruminating or they're stressed, I think there's an aspect of a spiritual connection that can help with that, where you're at peace and you have this understanding that a lot of things are not in your control. So how do you let go of things? So I think that could also help, where you can do your best and be like, okay, I'm going to just go to sleep now. And then when tomorrow arrives, I'll deal with things to the best of my capability. And I think a lot of different practices outside of religion, in terms of outside of the Abrahamic faiths, I would say like yoga, for example. I know for a lot of people, if they do yoga late at night or in the evening, that can also help, because you're relaxing it to a certain extent. You're focusing on your breath, and it is meditative in a sense. So that also helps from that standpoint.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that is most of what is prominent, at least in American medical practice, that you will get resources commonly for guided imagery, for deep breathing, for yoga, and things of that nature. So I think for people who fit into that population, it's a little bit easier for them to access kind of supplementary resources to support their journey through the sleepless night. Whereas I found like people from religious background, that they might have like unique barriers to sleep, but also unique demands. So like for people who are Muslim and are celebrating Ramadan, and then you are having the intermittent fasting during the day, that's going to have specific changes in your lifestyle that on the surface, we might say there's some research that says that people who are practice Ramadan, they have slightly less total hours of sleep. There is a systematic review and meta-analysis that said, yeah, it looks like maybe roughly an hour during Ramadan. But then that goes back to what we were talking about with that total sleep quality of if I have this mindset that, oh, any amount of losing sleep is bad, then it would be easy to make these logical jumps to say, oh, Ramadan is bad because you're not getting enough sleep. Versus if you have a total sleep quality kind of view, that same systematic review and meta-analysis found that when we asked people about their sleepiness during the day, that there was relatively like no significant impact on practicing Ramadan and experiencing daytime sleepiness as well. And so I think that the reason why I bring that up too is just that is a very specific lifestyle factor that's going to impact people's sleep. And if you don't have that cultural understanding and relevance, then it's easy to, as like a practitioner of medicine, to just like disregard or to not really bring into the recommendations that you are giving them. Because I would imagine if you are practicing fasting, then that's going to impact how much I'm eating in the morning, what time I'm waking up in the morning to be able to eat. And then same thing in the evening. And if you're having more social interactions and activities and stuff like that, like even though you know you need to go to sleep, maybe you don't go to sleep during that time too.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to perhaps just out of personal interest, being a Muslim, focused on that piece too, because I think there is something about the less we eat, if we're fasting, it does improve our focus too. So maybe if you're compromising your sleep, then perhaps you're making up for it with the fasting in a way. So I don't know if that would equal out, but I think there are certain concerns for people because, as you can appreciate, the Muslims, we follow the lunar calendar. So Ramadan can fall in the summer months too, where the days are extremely long, depending on where you live too. And in those cases, you're not getting a whole lot of sleep at all, just because you're up for prayers and then you're having to wake up for dawn. So in those cases too, I think there could be some concerns.
Yeah. God bless any Muslims who are living in Alaska, because that would be rough.
Yes. Yeah. But there was something else you had mentioned to me, even with the Muslim prayer times, the five times a day can often follow the circadian rhythm, and that can help too for people, especially with the prayer times.
Yeah, absolutely. And like having that, there's some research that has also looked at people who are from like very Orthodox traditions too, where the longer that they are living their lives into this rhythm of fixed hour prayer, then that seems to have an impact on their sleep quality as well. And in the spiritual life, I think, like from a Christian perspective, we talk about how sleeplessness is almost like a fasting. And the early church didn't talk about it as watching and have an important part of having time or spending some time at night for watching. And from that perspective, I think one thing that religion does too is it acknowledges the soul and acknowledges the spirit. You can, not to get too meta or anything like that, if you have a mindset of me as a person, my desires, my intentions, my character, or all of those things, from a certain perspective, I would say those are all different aspects of the spirit of the soul. And so the spiritual life, how we go about trying to pursue that from a Christian lens, we talk about that as the Holy Spirit transforming our hearts and our desires and things of that nature, that comes to us through the body. And so these embodied practices like fasting or changing how we perceive our sleeplessness become these times to mold us as a person, a full person that is body and soul. And so I think a real beautiful thing from the narrative that we get from the Bible is that that sleep becomes this gift of all of creation, that we can really receive and come from a place that I don't have to strive. I don't have to worry in the same way, because I believe that there is some God who is in kind of control of all of these things. Mm-hmm. I think it's also a recognized pattern of how the world is ordered and created. I think even in the Quran, it talks about that the day is for working and the night is for sleeping. And yes. So you have a very similar message that you're getting in the first pages of the Bible too, of there is morning and there was evening and there was morning and the next day. And there is this rhythmic pattern that the ancients were aware of because they didn't have smartphones. They didn't have electricity or all of these things, but they were able to observe the world to be able to see this rhythmicity that naturally their worldview led them to believe we need to live into this rhythm because this is that, this is how things have been ordered and designed to be. And so I think regardless of your background or your tradition or where you're coming from, I think there is definitely wisdom in that. And there's an importance in recognizing that, recognizing my body. There is a certain Gnosticism of a disregard for the body that we saw in the Industrial Revolution, we're seeing now in the AI revolution and everything of that nature, of just trying to go beyond the limits of what I can do in my own 24-hour constraints or what I can do within my own body.
Yes.
And I think a beautiful thing for religion is that it brings us back to know, at least from the Christian faith, our bodies are good. Our bodies are part of the created order. Our bodies are part of the image of God. And so that needs to be recognized and acknowledged. And when you live into that reality, it's quite different from the reality that we're seeing now of efficiency, product, and all this stuff that's just moving on a train towards burnout.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, that just further emphasizes the importance of sleep, right? Now, I do want to end with some common myths around sleep. So I want to get your thoughts around what comes to mind for you when you think about common myths, and perhaps on the other side, the cognitive improvement that we can experience with managing our sleep based on everything we've talked about. I think it's obvious, but it might be worth just emphasizing. Maybe I'll lead this one in terms of common myths. One of the ones I always hear is I can catch up on my sleep. What are your thoughts around that?
Yes and no. Yes, in that you can try to get back whatever sleep pressure that has built up. So you can sleep longer in order to relieve that sleep pressure. But no, in that any damage that is done to your due to sleep deprivation cannot be undone by trying to sleep later.
Okay. Other myths that come to mind for you?
We talked a little bit about the myth of I can just be like a machine. I can just do whatever I can during my day. And if my computer has a sleep button, like maybe I should be the same way and I should just be able to immediately fall asleep. So thinking about making sure that you have that margin, have that space to transition to sleep, or even taking a farther step back and thinking like, what is it that's filling my days and does something need to shift in order for me to prioritize my sleep health? I'm trying to think if there's another big myth. We talked about this too, the sleep deprivation as like a badge of honor. And I think the flip side of that then is that sleepiness is weakness. And especially when I'm talking to medical professionals who are in training, and if they are in an environment where that is the attitude of saying, hey, sleepiness is a physiological sign that you have some barrier to good sleep. It is not, there's no moral judgment or anything there that is somehow you are less than or weaker or anything like that. And I think a difficult part of that too is that we all have different amounts of sleep that we need. So that might be another myth in and of itself, that we hear 7 to 9 hours, but that's not, I should strive for 9 hours. That's truly, some people need 7, some people need 9, and it is a bell curve. So there actually are people who are, we always think about those people who are in the 90th to 95th percentile. I'm not like so abnormal that I'm like out of the kind of two standards deviation, but I'm not back in the middle as well. So even though we say 7 to 9 hours, there are some people who need 6 and some people who need 10. And so if you're getting 6 hours, people love to grab onto that. And they're like, oh yeah, I'm one of the people that only needs 6 hours. We think that is a very small part of the population. So I always caveat that with, that is 6 hours. I wake up that full sated. I feel satisfied. I don't need anything to get me through the day. I feel alert and ready and prepared. I have no problems to falling asleep. I'm efficient with my sleep. All of those things is the 6 hours. So if you don't check off that full list, then you're probably somewhere close to the seven and you're just running off of the six.
Yes.
But we know I don't ascribe to conspiracy theories, but my one conspiracy theory that closest thing I would get to is that I think the people who created our systems were all short sleepers, that they just needed 6 hours of sleep. And so you can imagine it's really hard for a 6 hour sleeper to have empathy for a 10 hour sleeper because they're like, all I need is 6 hours. What are you doing? You're lazy. You're this, you're that kind of thing. And so that's a myth we need to break, is understanding there are people within our population that need more sleep, that need less sleep. So how do we find a way to flourish together?
Yeah, for sure. And what about naps? Naps good?
Yeah, I think it is, again, variable. So in my book, I say resist sleeping in and taking naps. And I tell people, I say resist for a reason, because so many are like, don't take away my naps, Dr. Long. Like, I need them to survive the thing. Mm-hmm. And it's all about duration and timing. If you're taking a 3 hour nap, you're not napping. You are sleeping. That is what you're doing. And if you take anywhere from we tip to say 5 to 15 minutes, but maybe even up to 20 minutes. The whole point of that, when we're going back to those stages of sleep, is we're just trying not to get down to that deep sleep. Because if you awaken from that, a lot of times you'll have more of that sleep inertia and you won't feel as refreshed from that nap. So a shorter nap. But the problem is people think a nap is supposed to be a sleep, and that I am just like totally out and I dream and then I wake back up and I feel refreshed. And so, no, we're not even trying to get to REM sleep here. And especially for people who have more of an overactive mind, they might not even recognize that they have actually fallen asleep. And that is its own separate problem that a lot of people experience with sleep, is that I can look at your brain and it says your brain is asleep. But then when I asked you how you slept, you were like, I slept 5 hours, but then your brain says you slept 7 hours. Mm. And so some of that can just be this misperception, and that I have so many things that are going on in my mind that it's like my mind isn't even registering that I have fallen asleep. And so oftentimes for those people, I try to take away the performance anxiety and don't even think about this as a nap. You are just, while you are reclining, closing your eyes, taking deep breaths and setting a timer for 20 minutes. Mm. And instead of the question being, did I fall asleep? The question is, how do I feel? Mm. Because if I notice the alarm goes off and I wake up, or I open my eyes and I'm like, oh, I feel more rested, or I'm not as tired, or it's not like, I can take on the world, I feel amazing, people's expectation. But really it is I just feel slightly better. And that is what a nap is supposed to. So then it's like, most likely later on, then I might say, you're probably falling asleep and we need to try and train your brain to learn how, when you're falling asleep. But then it takes away that anxiety and takes away that barrier for it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate all of that. I think we can probably nerd out for hours here, but I want to be mindful of your time too. But Dr. Long, thank you for coming on here, sharing all your insights and so much knowledge. I think this was full of information, so I'm sure the listeners will appreciate it. But for listeners that want to learn more about you, your work, your book, what are some ways they can do that?
Yeah, the easiest way would just be going to sleephabitsjournal.com. That'll take you to the book page, but then that also goes to my website, which is thewholeheartedmd.com. So then you can explore that if you want to follow me. There's links on there. I'm on social media as thewholeheartedmd, so you can find me there as well. And I usually tell people, like, if you Google Dr. Benjamin Long, there's not a lot of us, so I'm sure you'll find me somehow that way.
Awesome. We'll put all of that in the show notes, but thanks again. Really appreciate your time today, and thank you for educating us all.
Yeah, this was a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Ben. As always, please subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. That's the best and easiest way to support this podcast. And on Apple and Spotify, you can leave up to a 5-star review. Please check out the sponsors in the description, as well as the Easy Reflections newsletter, a zero-cost newsletter that goes out weekly where I explore different mental health topics and provide practical tips and insights for the reader. The link to the newsletter can be found in the show note captions, where you can subscribe directly. Thank you again, and until next time.